We just sang, I shall not be moved. I have seen lots of people that during the Lord's invitation, that was their theme song, I shall not be moved. The church at Philippi had a very, very special place in the heart of the Apostle Paul. The church at Philippi had its beginning when Paul and his company met for worship by the riverside. They had a prayer meeting there. Paul and the other preachers had a prayer meeting there with Lydia and with her household. Lydia was a prosperous businesswoman from the city of Thyatira. The Lord opened Lydia's heart, and she, as the Bible says, attended to the things that Paul spoke of. She was actually the first convert to Christianity on European soil. This church at Philippi was the very first church established on the continent of Europe. From that modest beginning at the riverside with Lydia and her household, the church at Philippi grew to become a great church. Our text this morning comes from Paul's letter to this church that he loved so dearly. The overriding theme of the church, the letter to the church at Philippi, is one of joy. It's one of rejoicing. Actually, those words, some form of joy or rejoicing, is actually used 17 times during the Philippian letter. Now, I want you to think about this, and I want you to get the picture. When Paul pens the words of our text, he's in prison in Rome. Philippians, along with Ephesians, Colossians, and Philemon, are actually referred to as the prison epistles. Writing from his prison cell, Paul knows that at some point in the future, that prison door is going to open. And Paul is going to stand trial before Nero. And when that door opens, Paul is going to travel one of two roads. There's the possibility that the verdict's going to be not guilty. And if that happens, Paul's going to again be able to visit that dearly loved Philippian church. He's going to hurry back to those friends that he loves so dearly, those friends he longs to see and to visit with, those friends he thinks about in this letter with such deep, overriding gratitude. In Philippians chapter 1 and verse 1, Paul says, I thank my God upon every remembrance of you. And so the thought of returning to them, the thought of being with them again, the thought of having fellowship and breaking bread with them again fills his heart with joy. Because if the verdict is not guilty, then freedom for Paul is going to mean meeting again with these dearly loved friends. It's going to mean going on with his great work of spreading the gospel. But then, Paul might be found guilty. And if the verdict is guilty, then the door is going to open on a different road. Because if the verdict is guilty, the door is going to open to the road of execution. It's going to be just a few steps. Paul's going to have to lay his head on the block. And the executioner's axe is going to come and put a grim period to Paul's earthly life. You see, at the time Paul writes this letter, death is not a remote possibility for him. It is actually a high probability. Can you, by an eye of faith, can you imagine and can you feel the mixture of emotions that are seething in the heart of the Apostle Paul as he writes this letter? One road leads to life and work and friends, and the other road leads to a ghastly death at the hands of a Roman executioner. And in the midst of all of this, here's what the apostle has to say for us in Philippians chapter 1 and verse 21. He says, for me to live is Christ, and for me to die is gain. For me to live is Christ, and to die is gain. When you get right down to it, Paul is holding up remarkably well for a man that is staring death in the face. Paul realizes that death is probably very near. He knows that ultimately it's an absolute certainty. And yet, I want you to look at the letter that he writes. And I want you to look at the joyous spirit with which Paul faces this ugly fact. He's not contemplating death with trembling knees and a pale face. There's no terror in his eyes at the possibility or probability of an early demise. And yet he's not trying to ignore the fact of death altogether. But if Paul's not facing death with trepidation and fear and terror, he's also not facing with a morbid earnestness or eagerness. You know, I've known people that were eager to die, it seemed like. My great-grandmother was one of them. I've heard reports of her that when she was in her early 50s, which is an age some of us, most of us, can only see in our rearview mirror. Somebody asked her one day, said, "Well, Ms. Gaskins, what are you doing?" She said, "Well, I'm just sitting." She was on the front porch in a rocking chair. "Ms. Gaskins, what are you doing?" "I'm just sitting here waiting to die." That was her attitude of life. And son of a gun, as the old boy said, about 30 years later, she did. She had a long wait, didn't she? There's something unhealthy about that. There's something unhealthy about the thinking and the attitude and the life of someone who is eagerly anticipating death. Because you see, here's a little known fact. That person that is eager to die is a person that's afraid to live. It's just as hurtful to be afraid of life as it is to be afraid of death. Paul wasn't afraid of either one. He wasn't afraid of life. He wasn't afraid of death. He faces both of them with a calm confidence and a calm joy. He says, "For me to live is Christ. For me to die is gain." He as much as says to God the same thing Jesus said in Gethsemane, "Thy will be done." If he's set free, he's going to see his friends again. He's going to be able to keep doing the work that's so near and so dear to his heart. And if he's condemned to death, it's going to mean something even better. He's going to get to see Jesus. That's why in verse 22 he says, "I don't know what to choose." He says in verse 22, "I am in a strait between the two." He says, "Because I want to depart and be with Christ, which is far better," he said. "But to abide in the flesh," he says, "that's more needful for you." He doesn't know what to do. I wonder sometimes, is it possible that in our humanity, we don't share the same faith that Paul had? Is it possible that we're not able to face the future with the calm confidence that Paul had? If that's the case, we must agree that the faith that Paul has is a faith worth having. Because Paul is able to look life and death in the face. And he looks life and death in the face, and he does it without fear. He does it not just without fear, but he also does it with great expectations. Whatever the future holds, Paul's faith makes it possible for him to live and to live joyously. Whether his faith guarantees the future or not, it guarantees the present. And you have to wonder, how can he stare death in the face and say to die is gain. He's not able to do that because that kind of attitude is inevitable. Because death is not always gain. We can conceive of circumstances where death is actually a total loss. Whether or not death is gain depends on the values of the man or the woman who dies. Suppose that all of a person's values are material. And suppose all of their values are tied to this present world. Instead of saying, "For me to live is Christ," that person says, "For me to live is the world." And for that person that's absorbed by the things of this world and obsessed by the things of this world, death is not gain. You remember the rich farmer of Luke chapter 12? His crops came forth abundantly. He said, "What will I do? I have no room to bestow all of my harvest." "This is what I'm going to do," he said. "I'll tear down my old barns. I'll build greater barns. And I'll say to my soul, thou hast much goods laid up for many years. Take thine ease, eat, drink, and be merry." And God called him a fool. God said, "Thou fool, this night thy soul shall be required of thee. And then who shall all these things be which thou possessest?" When death came for him, it did not enrich him. It left his hands as empty as the pockets of a shroud. And in case you're not familiar with it, funeral homes actually still sell shrouds. If you don't have proper clothes to bury your loved one in, you can still buy a shroud from the funeral home. And shrouds do not have pockets. So when I say his pockets were as empty as the pockets of a shroud, that means there was nothing. If all our values are material, and all of our values are encompassed by this world, death's going to rob us of everything. Or maybe we're like the rich man of Luke chapter 16. He would say, "For me to live is pleasure. A closet full of Armani suits, Allen Edmonds shoes, and a freezer full of prime rib and lobster." Now, in case you don't know it, that's 21st century for clothed in purple and fine linen and faring sumptuously every day. He lived for the pleasures of this world. And if that's all we do, death is going to strip us of our purple. It's going to rob us of our banquets. Because when that rich man died, he found himself in a situation where all of his vast wealth was not enough to buy a drop of water. So who is death gain for? Death is gain for those to whom life means what it meant to Paul. Death has no power to change character. And it's only those of us, those who can say, "For me to live is Christ." If we can say, "For me to live is Christ," then we can add that next sentence, "To die is gain." You see, Paul could answer every question about himself in terms of Jesus. When he said, "For me to live is Christ," that means Christ is the author of my life. He's saying, "I did not begin to live in a real sense until I met Jesus Christ." And he's no doubt thinking of that experience of his life 30 years earlier. When he was on his way to Damascus with letters in hand from the chief priest that if he found any Christians, he was to bind them and shackle them and bring them bound back to Jerusalem for trial. And on that road to Damascus, that great light knocked him down to his knees. And he heard a voice that said, "Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me?" And he didn't see anyone. He was blinded. He said, "Who art thou, Lord? I'm Jesus, whom thou persecutest. What do you want me to do, Lord?" "Go into the city, and there it'll be told you what you must do." He's on his way And he's doing now, when he writes this letter, what he had been on his way to punish others for doing. He's calling Jesus Lord. Because when he went into the city, Ananias the preacher came to him. And he said, "Saul, why tarriest thou? Arise and be baptized and wash away thy sins, calling on the name of the Lord." And that's what Paul did. And that's when Paul was reborn. That's when Paul began to serve Jesus. And that's why Paul can say, "For me to live is Christ and to die is gain." When he says, "For me to live is Christ," that meant for him to live was to reproduce Christ in his life. Beloved, that's what life needs to mean for all of us. That we are to reproduce in some fashion the virtues and the sacrificial deeds that made the life of Jesus the beautiful something that it was. Paul meant that Christ was the aim, the motive, and the goal of his life. That he only lived to please Christ. To possess Christ. To be like Him. That was the goal of all of his hopes, all of his dreams, and all of his prayers. Listen to what Paul has to say in Philippians chapter 3 and verses 7 and 8. "Those things that were gained to me, I counted lost for Jesus Christ. Doubtless I count all things but lost for the excellence of the knowledge of Christ Jesus my Lord, for whom I've suffered the loss of all things and do count them but dung that I might win Christ." Everything that life meant to Paul was summed up in Jesus Christ. You see, Paul lived in the expectation of gains beyond death. Paul believed that death was going to bring him into a more intimate fellowship with Jesus Christ. He said, "Having a desire to depart and be with Christ, which is far better." Paul believed that having lived with Him here, Paul would live with Jesus there. He had full confidence in that fact. That's why he wrote what he did in 2 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 12. When he said, "For the which cause I also suffer these things, nevertheless I am not ashamed." Why not, Paul? "For I know whom I have believed, and am persuaded that He is able to keep that which I've committed unto Him against that day." Paul also believed that death would bring him into a closer fellowship with his Lord. He believed he would have fellowship with the best that had lived and died through all the centuries. That was Paul's faith. Are you listening? Paul's faith can be our faith. Paul's faith can be my faith and your faith. I'm interested in that life to come. And I'm interested for many reasons. I think of the words of that song. "Oh, think of the home over there, by the side of the river of life, where the saints, all immortal and fair, are clothed in their garments of white." Another verse of that song reads, "Many dear to my heart over there are watching and waiting for me." I'm acquainted with some that have passed from this life into that land that's fairer than this. And I firmly believe there are many that I have known and I have loved who are there waiting for me. And I'm expecting that someday the pale horse and his rider are going to cross my threshold, and the adventure of death is going to bring me the finest of all my friendships and the richest of all my associations throughout all of eternity. I firmly believe that someday I'm going to lock arms once more with those that I have loved long since and lost for a while. Paul was sure of that. You and I can be too. Paul was sure that death was going to bring him into a clearer vision of Christ and bring him into more intimate fellowship with the saints of all ages. That it was going to bring him into an atmosphere that was home-like. Jesus talked about heaven. He thought of it as home in John chapter 14. Or words that Jesus spoke that have wrapped their arms around more stooped shoulders and they've given their touch of healing to more hurting hearts than any words ever uttered. Jesus says, "Let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you, I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I'll come again and receive you unto myself, that where I am, you may be also." Blessed thought and happy day. Heaven's going to be home. And the same things that make a home home here are going to make it home in the sweet by and by. Love. Love is going to make it a home because love is what makes home home. And in heaven, we're going to be surrounded by the love of God and the love of the Lord Jesus Christ throughout all ages, world without end. It's going to be a land with a clearer vision of Jesus, a land of sweet fellowship, a land where we will be unhampered by the infirmities that we have to bear in this life. What'd you say, Paul? For me to live is Christ. Now here's the great question. Are you able to say that this morning? Are you living your life within the will of God? Are you living God's kind of life? You see, heaven is not going to be a participation trophy. Heaven's going to be a reward for those who live God's kind of life and live it faithfully. Listen to the words of Jesus in Matthew 7, verse 21. "Not everyone that saith unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he that doeth the will of my Father which is in heaven." Listen to what John would write in Revelation 22, verse 14. "Blessed are they that do His commandments, that they may have a right to the tree of life and may enter in through the gates to that city." Are you living your life within the will of God? Is Jesus the Lord and Master of your life? Not just part of your life, not some little corner of your life. Is Jesus the Lord and the Master of all of your life? This will make 1,001 times I've said this, at least. If Jesus Christ is not Lord of all of your life, Jesus Christ is not Lord at all in your life, are there changes that need to be made? Do you need to make changes in your life to be able to say with Paul, "For me to live is Christ and to die is gain"? Can we help you make those changes? This is your opportunity to do that. As together we stand and while we sing.